Blog Talk Radio.
Doesn't get any better. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us today. It's I know it can become a bit alarming for some of us. Perhaps we're finding that Mercury is entering a Scorpio at the end of the month. Right now it's in Libra, and this is Venus. It enters Sagittarius. Remember this. You may mock this. Don't hold on here. This is this not so very long ago. This was the way that the learned people were dishing out advice, and these things were incredibly influential. Hegemony, think of that. Think of the influence of the stars, and as a sign of our progress or measure of our progress. We now treat it fancifully, but there are still people who are probing the deeper meaning, with that sense of alignment, that element of predictability. When you see these patterns, the recurring patterns, look around at and experience the phenomena around you, we begin to see some very brief influences that come and go that really can influence our well-being and our day. You know, if we're of that mind, it's like reading your horoscope. Absolutely. The sky divided up into 12 areas. You know, this zodiac. We owe much of this, of course, to the science of Arabia, don't we? The Middle East, absolutely. When you think about is it about 75% of the stars that have names that are Arabic? Yeah, now correct me. I'm probably wrong, and I'm probably abusing a whole number of tribes and language groups, and I apologize for that. But you see the point. You see the point. Ego, and we even measure that. We've measured these in terms of qualities. Just a quick rundown. I'll presume that you may have some sense of your astrological sign. Sun equals ego and self. Moon, emotion and moods. Mercury, communication and thinking. Venus, harmony and affections. Mars, confidence and energies. Jupiter, prosperity and good fortune. Saturn, limitations and practicality. Uranus, individuality and inventiveness. Neptune, idealism and compassion. And Pluto, transformation, power. You see, so you can imagine, well, if we ascribe those kind of qualities, you look at the list of the attributes, that's quite a telling about an understanding of the human condition, isn't it? What bearing does it have? Absolutely. The essential question, what bearing does it have? What can you absorb from these things? Well, you may not be thinking that it has a direct connection to you. You may not be that tuned into it, or you may well be. You may well be the person that does perceive aura. Then for me to mock you and say, oh my goodness, that's ridiculous because it's irrational to my mind, the way I was taught, that's irrational. So you too, and what you're saying is irrational. That's just bad manners. I may disagree with your point of view. I may not see it, but to mock you? No, that's not right. That's not right. Here, we at least try it. You think about how you, and not only ascribes a certain, excuse me, a certain mindset, but a certain outcome. Affection, thinking, compassion, inventiveness, things that we would want the people that we love and care about to experience. To have some sense of themselves, of self-awareness. Without that, you become that insufferable. Oh, good grief. I'm in charge of the world and everything. I was just at a chess tournament. And as you know, you tend to meet these very strong personalities. Not all of them are well brought up. But you see their inability to handle the situation of being shown as sort of this rudeness. Little things, but gaming. It was silly because it's sort of evident. There, you can guess that I have come down with I'm experiencing one of those little elements that are unseen. Yeah, it caught me. So if you're one of the cardinal signs, Aries, Cancer, Libra, Capricorn, bless you. If you're a fixed sign, Taurus, Leo, Scorpio, Aquarius, love you. Oh, no. The mutable signs, we should talk Gemini, Virgo, Sagittarius, and Pisces. So whether you're energetic or you're said to be energetic, but you're not exactly reveling in it. These were very powerful influences. So with my learned gallery of listeners out there from around the world, and welcome. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in wherever you are, whatever your conditions. I'm very grateful that you found your way back to it. We can connect. Influences have replaced them today. Really. But these were answers to something. These were answers to some questions. So if you and I sit down and think, what questions were people trying to answer with this? The great unknown, an understanding wanting some sense of understanding and predictability. Realizing, or is it realizing that within your own self that superstition is superstition? It's not factual. Do you need all the science? Do you need the advances that we have in order to understand that perhaps the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, were onto something just by doubting? Well, next time you're in the company of a skeptic, at least recognize the benefits of that. You control it. You get to, if you're talking to the the petulance of a 13 or 14 year old little girl. That's a whole different matter, but it's similar. We teach skepticism as a form of safety. Somebody teaching and telling you something, don't always take it at face value, unless it congeals, unless it fits with our value system, and then we'll tell you that it's okay. As long as you're obedient to that, we're perfectly fine. But then, oh my goodness, along comes this crowd, and they didn't come overnight. If they had come overnight, then one of the powers, one of the estates, could have done something about it. One of the royalty or the church, who could have stamped it out. Absolutely, they were good at doing that for 1,000 years. The churches grew a great deal of influence and property, you know, wealth, which was a sign of dominance. Yeah. But it didn't. Then the nastiness of it was that it came in bits and pieces, and it was stretched beyond a lifetime of the emperor. And you know, emperors are a lot like. Well, you see I look at it, you know, fondly when I see that with the passage of our administration and our governance, it's the beauty of our system. But it's odd, I think, very odd that these fellows don't pass along. It's not the baton of knowledge and that they're passing along. It's like, I have my own, thank you very much. I have my own baton, and you've had yours, and so we're going to move away from that. Always in the back of the mind is that big question, the more superstitious question. You know, I'm ascribed to these roles, and it's really up to me. It's really up to me to read, but the readings that I see are like people, really they're trying to reinvent outcomes, trying to reinvent those outcomes. You know, those things that were ascribed to, even ascribed to the signs. Here are you and I are taught with astrology. The self represents ego, and that translates into self, sun, ego, self. The Venus, harmony and affections. It's like, well, we're okay with Venus. We're okay with what it's supposed to do, the symbol, and it represents harmony. But we're not okay with the phenomena, affections. We're not okay with that. So we're going to change that. And Mars, yes, it represents confidence. Oh, you would have thought it represents war, yeah? Well, how we've been socialized. But that confidence translates or transforms into an energy. Well, no. We're going to recreate these. And oh, my goodness, son of a gun, I have enough sense of my own authority that I can do that. I can recreate that. Thank goodness we have... we have a different kind of leadership within Freemasonry. Man, it's just gorgeous. It's like, I know I'll reveal my age here and my roots, but you remember when Ferrari was coming onto the market? You know, think of the Ferrari in the 50s. It was a this was beauty. These cars were being manufactured with these lines that were, and this power, it was every little boy's dream, I think. Could we say? All right, but you know what I mean. We had that, but it came and went. It came and went. Not to say there was anything wrong with it. There wasn't. It was just absolutely wonderful. But when you could change, you know, our current idea is it's like playing a rock, paper, scissors result with all of these things. If I tweak one of them, I'll look at and see if I can get a good outcome. But my goodness, what we're describing here, in 13th, 14th century astrology, would do that there was interplay. So we're the banner for scientific reason. Okay, where's the interplay? Oh, the chemistry, truthfully, if we change one chemical compound in our elixir, our tincture, we change the whole thing. That's why when we're taking a whole bunch of medication, chewing them all down, they're all doing wonderful things. Well, we actually don't know what we've created with all those compounds. So it's like looking, studying that is fascinating. Throw your hands in the air and say, we need to make more sacrifice of wheat or something else on our altar. We'll go to cut down an oak tree. Don't panic. It's your ego getting away, I think. It slips into a bit of paranoia if you lose track of that sense of will and purpose and understanding. If you lose track of that grounding, you can become quite worried and troubled, and we do, and that's not a pathology. That's the speed of the way that we process things. So, if you're looking at, A plus B equals C kind of life, if I should be able to aim at, I can change these different configurations. I can change the interpretation. I can tell myself, I'm brilliant in every way. The sun shines out of my orifices. and I am all being, all knowing, all understanding. So if I say something is going to be, then it is. Well, we don't know that, but we see that a lot. And we see that played out with some discomfort. Because the people that are doing that always have to keep it up. They always, it doesn't stop because it doesn't, you keep it up because it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You search for respect. All you can get is fear. Well, fear is respect. Yeah, really? Really? Since when, Genghis? No. Respect is entirely different. You get that mindset, get everybody's attention, and then show a curiosity about people's faith and their history, the uniqueness of different cultures. That part is respect. How to reconcile those two? Well, that's been the work of, a contemporary culture and society. Now, we have these beautiful, beautiful bits of information coming to us, and it does in some way affect the thinking, affect the way we look at things and think about it. Now, tell me, is there anybody out there who, we were taught there was a permanence, everything that we have around us is going to go on and on and on forever. And then we find out, no. And we were taught that it is this way. There's some comfort in it. You can believe it. But trust us. And it's going to go on and on forever. And then science comes along and says, no. You know, we've noticed that big nuclear reactor we call our star, the sun, is giving off material. What do you mean giving it off? You know, is there going to be a day when there is no more of it? Well, yeah. And then the physicists have said, when you do that, there's certain attractions and certain processes that are put into effect. Men, white dwarf, red star, we have all of those different conditions, and they've observed them in space. The light is reaching us now from things that have happened a billion years ago. What if, well, it's not a what if, it's like these things happen all the time, and does it alter our thinking? Well, the interesting question is, how does it alter our thinking? Well, that's, or do I rely on you? Well, I rely on you. I rely on expertise to help me. I'm fascinated when I'm listening to Dr. Brian Cox or DeGrasse talking about the cosmos and what's happening around us. It's absolutely fascinating. And I rely on the credibility of their thinking. The your credibility matters tremendously to me. Not so much, you know, unfounded opinion. That I got through when I was a teenager. You know, everybody, now it's stretched, it seems, stretched out a bit into people's 30s. Full of opinion, not really kind of short on facts, you know. The Flat Earth Society, and as I was saying, we still have people that adhere to these old beliefs because there was something about them that was of value. And we have this capacity for nostalgia. Yeah, you know. Do we want to re-science? Some of that is like restorative. You know, we're nostalgic because we think somehow we can turn back time and it was simpler then. What was simpler was our perspective on it. A child's understanding of conditions is a lot simpler, unless you get an adult acting as if they can compete with a child, which we do see quite regularly. How does this fit in the wheelhouse of masonry, you might ask? Well, it does. You have a perspective on what's going on within you about the influences all around you. Do you want or do you need the influences that masonry tends to offer? And what happens if you do embrace that? What in the world is the outcome? Well, we can't really, your experiment, yes, you are the embodiment of an experiment. How much different, how many of these different influences do you absorb at any given time? And then what effect does it have? Well, when we're taught that there's an essential intellectual outcome, but that it challenges and it's not for the faint of heart, we should take that really seriously. How do you understand life without understanding suffering and loss and pain? Does it make you determine that everything, that you have a legitimacy that other people don't, unless they've gone through something like that? Well, not everybody gets a parade and a symbol and honors for facing cruelty and ugliness and pain. Not everybody does. I think of all of the here, I think about the condition, well, not only here, the condition of equality that's plaguing women in our world. Entire world, 2022, boys still haven't figured it out. Oh, we talk about it. We've set up the systems and the constitutions. We've argued the morality. But just like we could in days gone by, we found that there's no authority, moral or otherwise, that can compel us to act on that. I think in some ways, racism is the harsh reality of this kind of thinking, and we haven't solved that yet. We have the solution, but we still rooting out examples. We have scientists calculating the number of slaves that exist on the planet today. I thought my little experience that we had ended that, but then I see decisions being made that seem to be driven by an ideology that makes no sense. It's harsh and it's cruel and it's limiting. So this, where am I going with this? Simply to underscore the importance of your experiment. What truths do you find? What truths bind you to a way of life? And are you Are you feeling it? Are you feeling that are you feeling the growth? Are you feeling with all of the, and it's really a narrow vision or narrow understanding, very thin, superficial understanding of what's going on. You know, it's not the forces of the universe aren't in competition, they're in balance. Oh, I don't necessarily say that as if I've discovered that for myself, but I've listened to other people who have the math to, and when I think about the work without making judgments about it, these things are in balance. It's like the polarities are in balance. And then does that kind of thinking, does that change your thinking about what's going on with boots on the ground, what's going on around us day by day? Well, yeah, it does. It does. Where do you go with that? Wow. Here's something that might help. And it's a pleasure. Sit back, relax, have your glass of your favorite, the beverage that you love, and let's get on with this. I know, the Modern Jazz Quartet. It's hard just to have a sample of their music without, you know, I just want to sit back and enjoy the rest. Huh? Here, a bit of continuity. A bit of continuity for you. This is the commentary today is entitled Movement. Let's see what you think of this. Does being around men having intelligent conversation influence you? Well, first I have to put my hand up here. If you're talking about hubris, no. Somebody bragging about, you know, I'm so smart. But let's park those people. They're not part of what I'm getting at here. You know, the person, when they sign their name, they have to write every credential they ever had in their entire life. I always liked the signature that's just one name, Rick. There, that's it. That's all. Yeah, I know. Or if you think, did Einstein or Mozart or Da Vinci, did they write down every, you know, the creator of the David and and E=mc², you know, do you think that we needed that constant drivel? It's really a reflection of ego, isn't it? I want you to think that I'm more important than I may be. And my Lord knows that I don't have a lot going for me, so I've got to collect everything. You know, I helped in 1956, I helped a little old lady cross the street at an intersection. So do you love me now? Does being around men having intelligent conversation influence you? They say influence. And I recall once being asked to schedule a meeting in which we would be spontaneous and think outside the box about some organizational mischiefs. And I lost my boyish charm with that group, explaining I didn't know how to plan spontaneity. And I wasn't being cute about it. I had no clue. So I sat quietly, befuddled, disappointed at what I heard. But as you can tell, it is with me to this day, many decades later. Learning from history can tell us much about ourselves. If that is what we are questioning, what of rightness or accuracy? Begin with what you have. It may be refined through life. It may be challenged and entirely replaced. Or it might be validated. Being open to those possibilities doesn't mean we won't ever experience disappointments. It means that they will be in this broader context, what we can learn from them. Can we integrate that learning, you know? Or do we store it away until we find a use? I love that masonry provides an academic in use with incredible challenges at the same time, instilling in us the manner of a gentleman content, knowing what he doesn't know is always greater than his knowledge at any given day. If we aren't sure about masonry, we can act as if we are. We can act with a sense of respect, embracing diversity, challenging ourselves to answer the question about a good life, being connected to a virtuous life. Whoa, we should stop and debate that, don't you think? That darn Aristotle, I don't think he was right all the time. He was infallible, as we know, but was Aristotle accurate in thinking virtue was the source of a good life? That is where we find ourselves realizing we begin the conversation with a firmer understanding of his terms and our own. We're more knowing morality, or are we? Is it something that is lost as we grow old and need to restore? We do become tired. There are days when we aren't inspired or searching, but observing. We always know the difference between a pause and avoidance. So be generous, my brother. Be generous. We know these things. What do you think? See the movement I'm talking about? It's an intellectual movement of that pin, of that understanding. that we understand things, do we also understand how we ought to apply them or where they ought to be applied? I don't know. Well, we have examples of material where people tell us that. You think about all the great literature, Thomas Paine, or Moore's work on Utopia, or Dickens' work, you know, Tale of Two Cities. You know, we have people illustrating for us the condition. You know, if we think about, you know, Heathcliff and how graphic that was in our memory. It was really, in a way, a wake-up call. Like, this is what's really going on. You know, we can have the fanciful notions. We can create the illusion. You know, the Empress, they created entire little towns. They were all just fronts. They were like a studio fronts, little beautiful little towns for the Empress when she traveled across Russia. And they would be assembled before she arrived and disassembled after she left. Always creating this illusion of these beautiful, charming little towns. We know of empresses that created these charming little farms so they could go and be with the people. They could go and pet the lambs and walk the ponies and feed the ducks. Indulgences, isn't it? So when we think about all that we know, sometimes it does take us a moment where we're not competing because somebody says we ought to know everything all the time. No, this isn't the politics of life. This is life itself. Where we do need to be able to do the math and reason things through. I think. This is Martin Taylor from his album Portraits. Why Did I Choose You? Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you, Pythagoras, for pointing that out. The unity, the music. Thank you. Today we're showcasing a poet from the 19th century, the American poet. He's considered the most popular American poet. He wrote Paul Revere's Ride, a story that was made. It was a bit of an embellishment, but that always makes a better story. This is a fellow of privilege, like some poets. Some aren't. I do talk about the people with the struggle. This is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. He attended, he was private school, graduated from college in 1825. And he liked, what's not to like? He enjoyed, as we know, the influences of Sir Walter Scott and Washington Irving's work. And when he began writing his poetry, it was put out in national magazines. He was able to translate, so he was offered a professorship in modern languages, provided that he would first study in Europe. Oh, gee, what a hardship, eh? So on the continent, he learned French, Spanish, and Italian, and he didn't really settle down into a regimen of scholarship in any university. So 1829, he came back to be a professor and librarian at the college, his alma mater. And he wrote textbooks, translated poetry and prose, and he wrote essays in those languages, French, Spanish, and Italian. But he wasn't feeling connected. So, you go over and experience culture over there, and then you come back to this. Okay, so he went back there. Even though he was offered a professorship at Harvard, it was in the day before people were throwing millions at their little spuds education, hoping that it would get him a job because he wasn't really that clever in the first place. So, but he needed all those magical connections for business and politics. But he went back to Germany. Whew. And then he went from that. He visited England, Sweden, and the Netherlands. This is, places where you were looking at intellectual depth, I'm saying. 1835, his first wife died, very sad, and they'd only been married for 3 or 4 years. But he settled in Heidelberg, and he absolutely enjoyed. We already talked about the Romanticism, the period where we were beginning. Hard to this as it is to believe, we're beginning to see the expression of the human condition in poetry. So he returned 1836. He came back, settled to Harvard, and he went to something called. He was living in something called the Craigie House, and that was given to him as a wedding present when he remarried. So people were paying attention to the presence of the man. And that's where he began publishing. He published Voices of the Night. They contained the poems, Hymn to the Night, the Psalm of Life, and the Light of the Stars. And he was immediately popular. And that same year, he published Hyperion, a romantic novel that, talked about the highlights of his European travels. And he began, just shortly after, he published ballads and other poems, The Shipwreck of the Hesperus and The Village of the Blacksmith, those types of anti-slavery sentiments he expressed in poems on slavery that very same year. He wasn't blinking. Typical of these courageous poets, they just tweak our nose, their nose of power and fear. They just do, they're brave. But anyway, he lacked, some said that he lacked the humanity and power of that guy, John Greenleaf Whittier's denunciations of the theme. Okay, so they were more outspoken. Yeah, there always is, eh? But he wrote. So anyway, you get a sense of the guy. You get a sense of the man. And I'm not going to get into some of his work I find quite interesting. Tales of a Wayside Inn. It's roughly modeled. He read Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, And you can see the influence in the Tales of a Wayside Inn. And Paul Revere's Rye became a national favorite. But it was recalling a hero of the American Revolution. We don't want to get into what really was going on in that whole business about taxation and what it disguised about the rules for our expansion. You know, there's, you know, pretty clearly, you know, if you're expanding the Americas as it moved west, there wasn't going to be any slavery. We can't have that. We have to have slavery, you know. Anyway, here's how beautiful is the rain. No loss of irony with this one around the world. Absolutely none. And that young 19-year-old Swedish woman making her protest, it's eerie. It's eerie. When we see the effects, she wasn't new at it. She was not new at it. She was saying things that had been pronounced in the 50s and 60s. Floods. Well, here we're not going to think that the rain is beautiful. And drought. Is seeding the clouds with nitrates? You know, are we still thinking that we are in charge of the elements, that we dominate, that all of this is a repository of raw material for our industry? Is that really? Well, okay, you knew there had to be a day of reckoning. Well, an era of reckoning is on us. And the tornadoes that are happening and the ferocity. And it's not that we have won and then we recover. It's bang, 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 bang. And the South Pole, record colds, minus 61 degrees this last year. Oh, so that means things aren't heating up. Well, you silly sod, we're not talking about the weather. We're talking about the environment. What's concerning us is the temperature increase in the oceans. Yeah, the salinity, you know, we need to, yeah. Does it matter? Well, by the way, have you seen the keys to my car? You know, I need to fill it up with another tank of fossil fuel. Eh? How beautiful is the rain? Get this. This poem begins with a description of rain following a dry, hot climate. So this will, some of you listeners will be able to relate to this. And it's describing being full of energy. A sick man sees the rain cooling and soothing effects of the outside world, and his fever is cooled and soothed. A group of rambunctious boys coming from school, and the gushing turbulence of the rain is compared with the energy they have. The water streaming down the streets mimics their own energetic play. Somehow the playtime has stopped. How beautiful is the rain. After the dust and heat in the broad and fiery street, in the narrow lane, how beautiful is the rain. How it clatters along the roofs like the tramp of hooves. How it gushes and struggles out from the throat of the overflowing spout. Across the window pane, it pours and pours, and swift and wide, like a river down the gutter, roars. The rain, the welcome rain. The sick man from his chamber looks at the twisted brooks. He can feel the cool breathe of each little pool. His fevered brain grows calm again, and he breathes a blessing on the rain. And from the neighboring school come the boys, with more than their wonted noise and commotion, and down the wet streets, and they sail their mimic fleets, till the treacherous pool engulfs them in this whirling and turbulent ocean. In the country on every side, from far and wide, like a leopard's tawny and spotted hide, stretches the plain to the dry grass and the drier grain. How welcome is the rain. In the furrowed land, the toilsome and patient oxen stand, lifting the yoke-encumbered head with their dilated nostrils spread. They silently inhale the clover-scented gale and the vapors that arise from the well-watered and smoking soil. For the rest in the furrow after toil, their large and lustrous eyes seem to thank the Lord more than man's spoken word. Near at hand from the sheltering trees, the farmer sees his pastures and his fields of grain as they bend their tops to the numberless beating drops of the incessant rain. He counts it as no sin. Then he sees therein only his thrift and gain. Who cares, eh? What does it matter? Who cares? Thank you. just something gentle about J.J. Johnson playing the trombone like that. And with, you can imagine Joe, it's strumming in the background. That's a jazz guitarist, Joe Pass. Just the timing. It's seamless. It's beautiful. Connects. Speaking about connections, would you mind if I know a cheap segue. Pardon me. I have a cold. Does that work? We're tipping into Amsterdam and we're still looking at the influence of English and Freemasonry, but look at the hub. And we're not talking about the center. We're talking about the influence from that to a hub of activity, of refinement, of culture, where people had the resources to develop the arts. And I mean that in the broadest possible sense. We note that the appearance of mystical language. Here we're getting into more of an interesting kind of the concept of mystical language in a mid-century lodge that was clearly engaged in a radical departure from acceptable gender-exclusive Freemasonry, focused our attention on the potential for innovation within this unique fraternity. The potential for innovation within this unique fraternity. I guess we'd have to, before we could conquer that and say, there is no innovation. Well, really? It's like, seems a little bit absurd. Depends what you mean, doesn't it? Well, yeah. And as soon as we ascribe a meaning to it, we're narrowing, we're leaving so much more on the shop floor. Its links with the Platonic and Hermetic traditions of the Renaissance, however tenuous by that time, made available a philosophical idealism that emphasized the mind or intellect as the sole criteria for judging the worthiness of an individual's merit and the quest for secret truth known only to the initiated. That's a challenge. This propensity toward the mystical within continental Freemasonry will surface increasingly during the second half of the 18th century. Out of this tendency came the mystical language of the radical Illuminati and other revolutionary secret societies modeled on the lodges. Well, that must have tweaked the argument that brought it all back, triggered it. There is no Illuminati. It never was. Yeah, okay. But the ideas that were packaged as Illuminati, what about those? There are no links between those revolutionary secret societies and the earlier lodges of adoption. That is not the point. What is important about Masonic idealism and its propensity to search for mystical language was the power it gave to men and women to express dreams and fantasies rooted in their contemporary circumstances, as they imagined them transformed. You'd really have to dig into that one. And by the way, yes, I'd like it's your round to open up that conversation. To look at that, when we sit down again, bring your magnifying glass, because we really need to look at this one a little more carefully, because it has some gems in it, eh? To justify this lodge, which met briefly in The Hague, brothers made reference to the myth of Plato's cave. In the 18th century, feminist sentiment can also be found in Neoplatonic circles. The impulse to search for enlightenment sometimes bring with it a recourse of illumination, particularly when the ideal bore so little relation to the reality around it. I think, and we'll get into this next. I don't want to go too far into this right away. At La Longue de Juste, mystical language provided the means for expressing egalitarian social behavior. Now, I don't want to go too far down this path today, because it's packed. It's crammed with lots of with things that we ought to consider. Isn't this saying to us, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, isn't the point that what the individual, what I understand or what you understand can bring a profoundness to it, if that's the way you experience it? And if we're told that so many of these aspects can be profound and inspiring, and we don't get it, to suggest that there's something wrong, I think, is limiting our sense of perspective. I think what it says greatly is that you need to be prepared to not be following the popular path, but be following your own, to be weighing and sorting through what's rational, what's irrational, according to you. Oh, you want to fit in with all the rest? Well, the only way to fit in with all the rest, the big picture of masonry, the philosophical ideal, is to follow that path of individuality. Because I think there's that sense, I'm impressed with the sense that if we do, then we trust the sciences. We trust the arts. We trust that we're going to find beauty and truths. We're going to understand. There's going to be an accuracy. And it's like we may be making different calculations, but if we trust the facts around us, then we ought to come up with similar conclusions. All right, so we could argue. Here we see, you know, they were talking about the myth of Plato's cave. We could, but as a thought experiment, it's wonderful. It's wonderful because he's sharing this idea about reality. What's real? What's illusion? Well, I live in a capitalist environment where illusion is sold. And this idea of invisible prison is sold. We're in prisons as long as we buy the premises and we don't question. And if we're told, well, you're happy, you're absolutely happy. So what we sell is the idea of happiness, not the idea of measuring reality. What's really going on with all of these, you know, with the polarization of wealth and the extremes of climate? Can we moderate by our own behavior? Well, the certain group of people tell us that that's not necessary, but look out, because what was one day weather is now an environment impacting us kind of seriously, very seriously. And we're told where this is going. So, and we know that the longer we try to ignore this, the fewer decisions we're going to have, the fewer choices we're going to have, because it'll be imposed on us by something even bigger than our own collective egos. My goodness. So do we put this in perspective and feel very bleak about it? I somehow don't think so. I think the likes of inspired people are going to teach the rest and are teaching the rest that we put one foot before the other and we carry on with whatever tomorrow brings. With whatever tomorrow brings. And some of us will be very good at working together in these great unities, and others will struggle. And what will be the deciding factor of unity or struggle? Well, history tells us that it has something to do with intelligence, doesn't it? With education, with a sense of values, not the Roman tyrants, you know, we're going to tell everybody and we're going to stratify. You're a slave. You're always, well, we'll give you slave rights, but not the vote, you know. We've evolved. That's the beauty of the Masonic perspective, isn't it? Just to be able to have look through that keyhole and then step away and think about what it is that you've been seeing. Whew. well. With sadness in my heart, I have to go. We have to part. I hope that you've found this interesting again and informative in some ways. It's part of a conversation. You're the other part of it that I need. I just want to sit back and you pick up the topic. Yes, next time it'll be your topic that we write around and we talk about. And the music, well, since we both are appreciate good jazz, well, let's keep that going on. And if this notion that, you know, we know more about where we're going by studying where we've been, well, that sort of justifies this idea of injecting history into our show. Thanks for sitting in. Wherever you are in the world, to folks in the continent of Africa that are tuning in, thanks. Bless you. Bless you. And from the reaches, the extent of the program is just fascinating to me. From Canada and the United States, from Turtle Island to the United Kingdom and Ireland and Turkey, way over to Latvia and New Zealand and China and Zambia, Oman and Pakistan and Iran. So much going on within the landscapes that are surrounding you, and yet here we are. I look forward to having you sit in with us again next week, and in the meantime, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and my goodness, include yourself, would you? Thanks for tuning in.